Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Gary Crabb. How are you, Gary?
Oh, wonderful, thank you.
Excellent, excellent. We're currently at Bald Hills Winery in Bannockburn in central Otago. Quite a few years ago now, probably 2007, 8 years ago, I was here interviewing Blair and Estelle, and I thought I'd do a catch-up with Blair and Estelle now that I'm back in New Zealand, and strange enough, they're not here. What the heck's happened?
They're on the Kapiti Coast enjoying life.
Are they?
Yes.
What's happened?
Blair and Estelle have sold the place. Mm-hmm. This in March 23rd, I remember the date, actually. I was there to give them champagne and oysters when the funds came through.
Yep.
And it was purchased by a Japanese gentleman known as Isao Mita.
Isao Mita. Okay, and who's Isao Mita?
He has been a great lover of New Zealand wine for quite a few years, and he originally discovered New Zealand wine by being, strangely, a yachtsman.
A lot of yachtsmen. No, New Zealand does have a lot of yachtsmen.
And a lot of drinkers. And yachting and drinking seems to go together. Strangely, even fine wine and yachting seems to go together.
Yeah, yeah.
And he primarily had a Kiwi crew running his boats within the Rolex series. Through that experience, New Zealanders presented him with New Zealand wine. And he was presented with a 2005 Bald Hills trophy-winning wine.
Yeah, that was the trophy-winning wine. It was quite nice. I've been drinking a bit of that over the years.
Rumor is you still have some. And
maybe. I'm actually not 100% sure. I might have. I know I pulled two bottles out recently and got through them.
I'm still looking for it, but I'd love to taste it. And he was completely transfixed by the wine. Serendipitously, Bald Hills was up for sale. Blair and Estelle had founded Bald Hills, planted Bald Hills. They were Bald Hills, and their whole personality was, and label was, this site.
Mm-hmm. And okay, so he's taken it over. And you're the manager here. What does that mean you do, Gary?
Everything that's required.
Really? Yeah, okay, I imagine Iso's not really a hardened viticulturist or a winemaker himself.
He starts everything from the palate and the importance of his whole judgment and his whole passion and his whole philosophy starts from his own palate and his own feeling about the wine and what it invokes within him. And that is the critical aspect. They've been very kind and allowed me quite a bit of freedom in the sense of allowing me to do things viticulturally that I think is necessary for the place. They do not interfere in that respect.
Yeah.
We have Pete Bartle, a fantastic winemaker from Vinpro Winery. Very experienced, very passionate, and extremely knowledgeable viticulturally. So Peter and I have been able to develop a good relationship together.
Yeah.
But Isao Mita, Mr. Mita, and his assistant Hiro, and his daughter especially, insist upon tasting all the barrels.
All the barrels.
And all the different blends within the barrels. And then thinking about putting together the different blends, the final blends.
Yeah.
Very interesting from an owner to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And for an owner to have the confidence within their own palate to be willing to do that.
But Bald Hills used to just have a single Bald Hills, two Pinot Noir from Bannockburn. Have they got multiple?
They had multiple tiers.
Oh, they did?
Yeah, they had a 3 acres, which was a earlier release, slightly lighter style.
Mm-hmm.
The 2013 won the Brigado Trophy, which means the best single vineyard owner-grown wine in New Zealand. So okay. It's got a great pedigree as well, too. And that was for early release, very perfumed, very bright, lovely wine. But they also used some of the other clones, such as 10 Bar 5, the gruntier sort of Pinot Noir, to make a heavier, longer aging, structured wine, which was a single vineyard wine.
Okay, and that's the one that got the IWC a few years ago?
Yes, yes.
That's the one I know best.
But I think Blair was very astute because rather than sitting on wine, waiting it to age a couple of years, he released the 3 acres label, which was able to generate cash flow.
Yeah.
He was very astute in terms of business and understanding how that was important was to keep income generating within that.
Okay. The interesting thing about Bald Hills is that, for me, the Central Otago Wine Industry is must be only about 30 years old now, but...
And that's even stretching it, really.
Yeah, yeah. That was probably when Ripon first planted up. And they were the lone weirdos on the in Wanaka for quite some time, and maybe only really mainstream, going mainstream 10, 15 years, really,
true,
isn't it?
True, before volumes got up, yes.
Yeah, and if you think about it, Blair and Estelle from Bald Hills and a lot of these entrepreneurial wine makers, I sort of was talking to you and I was thinking that maybe some of these people are looking for exit strategies, you know, particularly if you set it up as a sort of a late retirement, but sort of in the later part of your life where a lot of people do, there must be some consolidation going on now or starting to. You saw it in Marlborough quite a while ago. Is that sort of thing starting to kick in now?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think as you touched on, partly is age, as people have aged a little bit more and gone further into retirement. It's the effort and requirement in a vineyard is a lot more than you'd ever imagine. Not just financially, but the worry, the risk that you take here in Otago. It's a massive risk. Even with all the best frost fighting equipment and everything, you can get low yields. And I think it's quite strenuous on an owner, to be honest. And all you need is a couple difficult vintages and profits sort of go a little bit sour. But the main thing that I think the most difficult thing is the effort required to sell the wine and to market the wine.
Yeah.
It takes a tremendous amount of A, effort, B, time, and C, unfortunately, a pile of money.
I tell you what, it's one of the things that everybody who wants to join the wine trade, not so much join the wine trade, everybody wants to start a wine business. First thing they do is go, oh, I want to do that. So they go off and source the wine, which is the fun bit. But you've got to be able to sell the stuff. And that's the hard bit. And that's the bit a lot of people get unstuck on, isn't it?
It's the scariest bit. It should scare people. But if you have a true passion for it, and if you have a desire for it, and you're willing to put in the time and to develop the relationships, because making fine wine and selling fine wine isn't about volume and shipping and all the rest of it. If you want to produce a truly great wine, it's about passion, it's about effort, it's about building long-term relationships, and especially if you're exporting, it can take 2 or 3 years of negotiating and toing and froing and multiple trips before you get that little look in, and you've got to develop a relationship, and that's not easy.
No. And I suppose there's different sizes in Central, but a lot of people think of Central Otago as being more of a boutique-y wine industry. You know, it's all small people setting up smallish vineyards, or historically.
From my understanding, and don't quote me exactly on these numbers, when I first started out in 1999 down here in Central Otago, the average vineyard size was 4.5 hectares.
Yeah.
Now, I think the most recent figures are 16 hectares.
Okay, so they're getting bigger.
I would say a lot of it has to do with consolidation. There hasn't been many very large plantings, but certainly there's been consolidation, and some labels have decided to stop producing wine and just selling the grapes.
Oh, okay.
Which is generally, unfortunately, just a slightly profitable enterprise.
Just slightly?
Just slightly. Because of the expense of growing the grapes down here, it's so much hands-on work to do. We cannot get mass production because Pinot Noir does not work towards mass production.
Yeah.
If you overcrop or if you don't want to put the effort in, it shows itself. Pinot Noir is naked. It's out there. You can't get away with cutting corners, and it's all expensive.
Yeah.
So even for the poor grower, the margins aren't the greatest.
So we were talking earlier about different size vineyards and sort of thing, and the smaller vineyards. Bald Hills is about 7 hectares.
Yes, that's
saying.
Correct. Yep.
So Bald Hills would very much be in that boutique-y size.
Correct.
But you do export, because I think you sell to Alice of Richmond in the UK, don't you?
Yes, a little bit. A little bit. We are looking towards Asia, towards our focus. We're going to open up a import hub in Singapore and a bonded warehouse there, and then distribute out of Singapore using that as a centralized hub.
Oh, okay.
And
is that because Isamita, he's Japanese, isn't he? But
he is Japanese, but we find Singapore is duty-free to bring the wine into, and I think it's the best export hub in Asia.
Better than Hong Kong?
There's a little bit of argument between the two of them. Hong Kong is certainly very few barriers in Hong Kong, and Singapore has tried to match that.
Yeah.
Selling into Singapore, that's quite expensive, their duties and taxes, but the re-export, there's no duty or import on that.
Yeah.
So they're trying to make themselves a wine hub, and we think that is a natural location for us to start looking as a hub to export wine.
Okay.
And it's not going to be easy, but there's a lot of people who assist us with re-exporting to other countries and looking at other markets from there.
All right. But at 7 hectares, in central anyway, but I always think of if you're between Queenstown and Cromwell, Queenstown being the big tourist area, Cromwell being more of a sort of local service town, really, isn't it?
To a degree, yes. It is changing.
Yeah.
It's significantly changing. I think Cromwell's becoming more of a wine destination.
Yeah.
And in the fact, especially with more sophisticated consumers who are willing to go further.
Yeah.
I think that some of the people who are willing to go to some of the top boutique wineries are willing to travel from Queenstown. Whereas if you're close to Queenstown in the Gibson Valley, Kawarau Gorge area, you tend to get a lot of less serious day trippers.
Yeah, exactly.
Sort of thing. So I think that there is a good potential here in Cromwell for those.
Oh, definitely. I think if I would have thought the reasonably serious wine drinkers staying in Queenstown would easily make it to Cromwell, Bannockburn, even up to Pisa, up to
Warnock. Yeah, the very serious ones will. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's still not volume or numbers.
Yeah, okay. Talking about that consolidation, your 7 hectares, I would have thought a lot of stuff traditionally would have been by cellar door, but just driving around here, there's so many new wineries since the last time I was here about 10 years ago, 8 years ago. So, you know, there seems to be a lot of stuff opening up.
I think a lot of people have realized that the best profit margin is through your cellar door. You can sell for full retail price.
Yeah.
And you can build a brand loyalty through a cellar door, and you can tell your story.
Yeah.
That was Blair and Estelle's success at Bald Hills, was Blair's and Estelle's personality. And they built loyalty. And that's the beauty of the cellar door. You know, and that's the important thing. You can tell your message and there's no one in the way to do it.
But the problem with that is you are limited. If there's more and more people selling cellar door,
yes,
eventually the competition is going to start, meaning that you're not going to sell through and you're going to be stuck with some product. Or
very true, very true. And also staff costs. Often there are many quiet times here.
Yeah.
And Bald Hills worked because Blair and Estelle lived here and worked the tasting room. They didn't have to pay someone else.
Okay, yeah.
If you have to pay someone and you have to pay staff, perhaps a lot of your margins disappear, especially if you're small.
Yeah.
And as traffic is building, that's great. But still, there's quite a bit of there's getting to be more and more competition. As more labels realize that the best profit center is to open a tasting room, perhaps.
So we said that there's a bit of consolidation going on. What do you think the next size up, if you like, from sort of being a small boutique is for Central Otago? Because each region is slightly different depending on the economics of scale. And
from what I've seen, you've got to go to the 35 to 40 hectare area size. And some people are even saying go to 80 hectares.
That's quite a big vineyard.
That's very large for Central Otago. There'd only be a few like that.
Who's that?
Akarua would be of that size. Peregrine is getting close to that. Gibson Valley is in the 50 size. Amosfield is in the 50 size. So those players have purchased land and have contract growers. Mount Difficulty, of course, have been very successful.
Yeah, they've got a lot of contracts, haven't
yes.
they?
Yes, yeah. They grow some of their own, lease some of it, and they've got contract growers. So what they've been able to build up to that size as well, too. And I think that's an important threshold to reach to develop a distribution network.
So that's when you can start having servicing multiple markets like
Correct.
UK or America
Correct.
And things like that.
And you can afford to go on a whirlwind tour, which is necessary, which is all very costly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the thing, isn't it? If you've got 7 hectares, it must be, you know, you can't export that much, which means recovering your exportation costs.
Well, that's why we're looking to develop a wine hub within Singapore. And moving everything out of that point, certainly from a logistics point of view, and trying to find a central place there.
So what, you can sell directly to restaurants in Vietnam or Thailand?
Yeah, there's direct exporters that allow you
to
going and finding it yourself. I mean, there will be people who specialize in direct export out of Singapore.
Oh, okay. So they'll do groupage. They'll get half a dozen producers together, groupage at Vietnam and supply restaurants and things like that.
Yeah, because that's where we see the future. We see Europe as fairly crowded and difficult. America has got its own difficulties, in Canada as well too.
Well, American, you can't move wine around, and each state's got.
And Canada's got. I'm Canadian, but we love rules.
Yeah,
and we've got plenty of rules and roadblocks to make things easy.
The wine boards or whatever.
In Canada. They're quite controlling. They are loosening up, and there are more opportunities, but there's still the government doesn't want to get rid of its revenue stream.
I think the Asian model, I don't mind just talking about that, because that seems quite different. So you get a central hub at Singapore,
mm-hmm.
and then you export to Singapore.
Bulk amounts of wine, so you can get a very good bulk rate.
Yeah, bulk to Singapore, and then you sell to an exporter,
mm-hmm.
and the exporter will take some of your wine, some of someone else's, create a pallet or whatever,
yep.
or is it a pallet? Would it be
pallets? Yeah, pallets, yes, exactly.
And then they'll export that to another region.
Being Indonesia,
yeah.
for example, Malaysia, but you know, markets that were quite difficult and you wouldn't have the ability to service yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they're able to do it.
So you're getting you are adding a middleman in there, aren't you?
Yes.
And are they, the exporters themselves, when the wine gets to Indonesia, they hold the wine and then from that they will supply restaurants themselves directly.
I'm no expert on this.
No.
But this is the model we are pursuing and that we're looking at next.
So it's like in London we have wholesalers.
Yes.
But this is like a wholesaler who covers London, France and Portugal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or something like that.
Yeah. And all of those markets are quite small and very difficult to penetrate yourself. And it's all about local relationships. But if you can find someone who's got the experience and knowledge within there, you can help service it later by doing tastings and things like that. But you need people on the ground who have understanding.
Yeah.
And my belief is I think that the countries that are really going to start growing in terms of wine consumption is going to be Korea, Taiwan, India, places like that. And I think Singapore is a natural hub to work out of it.
Everybody talks about China, and China doesn't drink much wine per head either yet, but then their high-quality wine's all been politically made harder.
I think there's been a huge shake-up in China of recent, and I think they're getting serious again.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the rogue players have been shaken out of the business, but it is hard work as well, too, I suspect.
Okay, and the middle-sized players, you're saying, you know, the sort of 35 to 50 hectare type sizes.
Yeah, that sort of area, yes.
They have wholesalers in each country. Like I can think of a lot of the middle-sized players you mentioned, like Mount Difficulty or Peregrine, or those guys. I know the wholesalers that they supply into the UK. Is there any really what you call a big player here in Central? You know, like
no,
you
I
think
don't,
of Montana or Brancott.
I've been told that all the very large players are scared because of our high land price. We don't fit into a proper profitability model because of our high production costs. Our difficulty in mass production,
mm-hmm.
And perhaps they're waiting. I don't know, but they're quietly buying fruit and testing the market.
Okay.
They don't make a big noise about it, but you will see quite a few of the large players with a Central Otago label.
Such as?
Constellation, for example, buys fruit down here. Cloudy Bay initially started buying fruit here, and then now they've actually bought a vineyard. And I think various people have come, and Matua is a perfect example. They purchased fruit for years, and now they've taken a long-term lease of a vineyard. So I think they just test the water, get the knowledge, find out the local players, and now they're coming down. But so far, no large-scale purchases, because there were quite isolated little pockets. There aren't any very large-scale, economy-of-scale vineyards to purchase.
And I suppose one of the things is if you do have quite significant frost risk or quantity production variation. If you've got all your eggs in one basket, that gives you quite a lot of business risk. Whereas if you're a bigger company and you've got it as just a sub brand, if you like, almost something goes wrong, it's not gonna.
Yeah, I don't think the accountants like Central Otago. High land price, high risk, great variability of crops. I think it's probably quite a scary venture for them. There's plenty of stories. We had a frost on the 4th of January, an unheard of event. Everyone was prepared for it.
Yeah.
But it's really here. It's really on the edge, as they've always said.
Yeah.
It's the edge of common sense, really.
And getting back to the middle-sized, small to middle-sized producer, it seems to be where the consolidation is going to occur.
Yeah, certainly. The middle, I think the small boutique player who, if you do your own work, do your homework, travel a long time on the road, you know, and put that effort in, and you've got to do it yourself as an owner, or one or two people are able to do it. That's possible.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult,
yeah,
but it is possible, and you have the ability to control your own quality.
Yeah.
And it comes down to the ability of controlling the quality of your production, which is quite easy on a small scale.
If you're not really hands-on, do you think it's the people who have done that, they've had enough of it? You know, traveling is not as exciting as some people think it is until you...
No, I don't think there's any particular... I think the gloss wears off fairly quickly.
Yeah, so do you think that that's where the consolidation's coming in?
I think so, yeah. I think that's a very... not as glamorous as people suddenly realize.
Yeah.
It's the wine industry is lovely, and there's many perks to it.
Yeah,
but it's certainly not ideal.
It's still farming in the end.
You're still farming, and you've still got heaps of risk.
Yeah,
in that respect.
Okay, and what's your prediction for the next couple of years? Do you think?
I think the consolidation will continue. I don't know, as you asked, whether a big player is going to come down. I think they'll continue to test the water, but we might be surprised.
Yeah,
seeing Cloudy Bay come down was a big. They've got a couple of vineyard sites now here.
Yeah,
and you just never know what's lurking on the horizon. There's a very limited amount of good land here.
Bannockburn's looking close to planted up, from what I've seen.
Yes, I always say the A sites are gone for the most part, unless there's something I can't find.
Yeah, yeah.
But the obvious ones are gone.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, and certainly the price has risen quite significantly in the last couple of years as people have realized that, and which makes even selling the wine even more difficult.
Yeah, because you got bigger mortgages.
Because you got bigger mortgages, and it becomes more and more difficult in that respect. And I don't see any, you know, frontier of inexpensive land for massive expansion around.
Yeah. Although there is some on the flat bits up Pisa Ways, Wanaka Ways.
Cherry growers are buying it all.
Are they? Oh, I like cherries. Yeah.
But the cherry guys are our biggest competition in putting the prices up. They're buying hundreds of hectares.
Are they?
Yeah.
Okay.
They've found some new export cherries. The profitability in cherries is our main competition, and that's pushing the land price up as well, too, because you can make tremendous profits in good years in cherries. I think this year would be fabulous. There's no rain, so I think the cherries guys have just had a bumper season.
I've eaten a lot of cherries recently, so yeah, yeah maybe. Yeah. Mind so you, I've drunk more wine than cherries.
Mix them together. But in a crystal ball, I think that the consolidation will continue. Be it good or be it bad, a rationalization, I think, is just a natural order, a natural process within capitalism. Yeah. And it is a very, very competitive market. And I think it's getting harder and harder to get you shelf space and get into restaurants. I know from my experience in Queenstown, you used to be able to go see a restaurant owner, get it onto a wine list, and build a bit of a relationship. Now, a lot of the restaurants are owned by corporate groups, and they purchase all from a large group, and it's harder for the players to get their nose into it.
Yeah,
and that's very difficult.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
I've approaching restaurants. It's not as used to be a handshake and share a drink, and you were in there, but it's not like that anymore.
All right, then. I think we're going to wrap it up there, Gary.
Yep.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for your time.
Cheers, bud.